Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Baseball America's Draft Podcast. I'm Carlos Collazo, joined, as always, by Peter Flaherty. What's up, Peter? How you doing, man?
I'm doing great. It's kind of hard to believe that there's only six weekend series left in the regular season.
Don't tell me that, Peter. Come on.
It's flown by. Every year just flies by, but we still have so much good baseball left to be played. The draft cycle's heating up, so there's a ton of fun stuff on the horizon.
I guess thinking about the college baseball regular season being done sucks, but we also still have a lot of postseason play that'll soak up some time and give us a lot more action. So how many total weeks do we have between tournaments and then the NCAA tournament?
Oh, that's a great question. So there are six weekends left in the regular season, but then it's almost like part two where we get all the conference tournaments. Yeah. Regional play starts up, and then Omaha. So there's not really a lull.
Yeah, the fact that college baseball's postseason is so extensive will help the lack of regular season games here. It does feel insane that it's gone by so quickly.
Oh, I know. It goes by in a flash. But like I love how volatile the rankings are this year. Outside of really Arkansas at one and Clemson at two in the last few weeks, it's been like, you can shuffle this thing any which way you want. We've had teams entering, teams exiting, teams jumping, teams falling. Like, I think it makes it so much fun to follow, and I hope and think it's going to make for a really, really fun postseason with a lot of upsets. At least it has the chance to be. Like, last year, it was Wake, LSU, and everyone else. This year, it's not that. Like, Arkansas, for me, is the best team in the country, but it is not as wide of a gap as it was. Yeah, exactly.
It feels like for people who are maybe not as dialed into college baseball already, a year like last year where you have powerhouses like LSU and Wake with really high-end prospects and notable players at like prime programs, like that seems good for college baseball just because it attracts a lot of maybe more casual fans who are dialing in. Whereas this year, if you're a diehard college baseball fan, you probably love this because you get so much back and forth and you don't know who's going to win on any given weekend series. It just, like, the open nature of it and the lack of a clear-cut top team, if you're already into college baseball, like the competitive side of college baseball, is probably more exciting to you than if you had just have one dominant team that you're kind of like, yeah, well, there's still one. So,
100%. Like you said, anyone could beat anyone on any given weekend. Even like, I'm really curious to see what it would be like if Arkansas's pitching falters on a weekend, how their offense would respond. I don't like, their pitching is good enough where they just might not have that hiccup of a weekend, but
do they still have like a full run on the next team in terms of team ERA? Cause last time I checked, they were like nearly a full run away from whoever was number two in team ERA.
Oh, I don't know if it's a full run. I think it's like, it's over half a run though. They have like a 2.5 team ERA, and then it's actually A&M who, for my money's worth, might be the most well-rounded team in all of college baseball. A&M's number two with like a 3.2 ERA.
You're right. Arkansas has a 2.56 ERA. Texas A&M is second with a 3.23 team ERA. So either way, still pretty impressive.
I love A&M, and not to go on the, this is the draft pod, not the college pod, but
go for it.
I'm big on the Aggies, so curious to see how they do this weekend in a top five showdown against Vanderbilt.
Yeah, no, it'll be another fun weekend. It always seems like that's the case for college baseball. But let's get into some draft prospects. The first guy I want to talk about, Peter, is a name that we really haven't been able to talk about much at all, and he might be one of the best hitters, one of the best overall players in the country. That's J.J. Weatherholt. After missing almost two full months, he is back on the field. In limited capacity, he had a three-game series against Kansas this past weekend. I was dialed into every one of those plate appearances, and it's just nice to see him back. He entered the year, obviously, as our number one player on the board. His track record of hitting is exceptional. What he's done with West Virginia, I mean, hitting .449 with 16 homers, 35 bags with West Virginia a year ago. He's not going to be able to have quite that season this year. And we still, I don't think, have him at 100% because he's playing DH. He's not really running full effort runs. But the bat looks real. The bat looks like it hasn't really dropped off at all. I thought he was making really strong swing decisions early on. He hit a home run distance ball the opposite way in foul territory in one of his ABs. A couple other balls hit hard to the warning track. So I thought the swing looked good early on, but how nice is it to have JJ Weatherholt back and playing?
Extremely nice. And like you said, selfishly, I was just super fired up to watch him again. And last weekend against Kansas, it really didn't look like he missed a beat. I thought he looked really comfortable in the box. You mentioned the professional approach he displayed, the outstanding bat-to-ball ability and knack for the barrel was there. He had a handful of hard-hit balls, and getting him back is huge for the West Virginia lineup. And then also from a draft standpoint, I think he's going to be an eventual top five-ish, top five to seven or so overall pick. And I think that it's crazy to say it just given the pick range we're talking about, but you could be getting a serious steal, I think, because as you mentioned and alluded to, coming into this year, he was the number one player on the draft board. He was squarely in the 1-1 conversation right there with Travis Bezzana, and at that point, Jack Caglione and just a couple of others before Condon started doing what he was doing. But like, for me, and you can still make this argument, like as far as best hitters are concerned, you can absolutely make the argument that JJ Weatherholt is the best pure hitter in college baseball. For me, I'd still probably lean Bezzana. It's hard not to after what he's done this year. But
and to your defense here, not that you really need defending on with what Travis Bezzana is doing, but even entering the year when Weatherholt was healthy and coming off his sensational season, you still were kind of a lean towards Bezzana in this area, I would say.
I've always been super enamored with Bezzana. I know that's easy to say now, but I was excited about him even when he was before he stepped foot onto campus at Oregon State. But back to Weatherholt, like he was like I had a 70 on the hit tool coming out of this summer, and like I haven't really strayed from that. The feel for the barrel again is off the charts. It's easy double plus bat speed. The contact ability is double plus. It's a really exciting offensive profile. And I know the hamstring injury has been kind of a nagging one for him. And it's not like, I mean, it's not great to have a nagging hamstring injury, but you know, you're also looking at a plus runner. He can drive the baseball to all fields. Like it's certainly hit over power, but he's not anemic up there when it comes to impact and power. Like he, over the summer when I saw him on the Cape, was driving the ball with wood, and this kid's a gamer. He's a baseball rat. So, you know, I'm excited to see what he does here in the last month and a half of the regular season. And I think, you know, you're going to luck out with one of the best pure hitters in the sport in the, like, you know, who's to tell how far he or how high he goes, but, someone in the top 10 is going to get really lucky.
Yeah. So right now through eight games, he's hitting 300, 436 with a 367 slug. He has yet to homer this year. I can't imagine it'll be too long before that comes around. It's kind of a similar scenario to the Nick Kurtz situation, although he's been better in his early games than Nick Kurtz's back of the baseball card statistics. I think the power will come. Maybe he won't quite have the home run binge that Nick Kurtz has been on in the last few weeks, which we'll get into. But like you mentioned about Weatherholt's power, I don't view him as this super hittability, no impact bat at all. Like you were saying, seeing him in the Cape Cod League driving the ball, he did the exact same with Team USA in Cary, North Carolina with Wood. Just how loud and strong his hands are, I think he's going to be a guy who will get to solid average or better power pretty consistently given his pure hitting chops. It's interesting thinking about him as a plus runner because over the last 8 months or so, I really haven't seen that because he's dealt with this hamstring injury. But the stolen base volume that he's had in his first two seasons with West Virginia and hearing you talk about him being a plus runner when he's healthy, it's just kind of an element of his game that I haven't really seen in a while. And I am curious how teams are going to view the kind of nagging hamstring injuries. I know that's maybe more concerning than like a broken finger or broken hand bone or something like that, where once you heal up, you don't expect it to be kind of a lingering issue. with how often he has dealt with this, I wonder how concerned teams will be moving forward of that either impacting his durability or impacting the run tool. Like, is it just assumed that he's going to come back and be a plus runner and be really active on the bases? I'm not sure how teams view that. It's definitely an important aspect of his game and what helps make him such a well-rounded player. I also think moving forward, there's a lot of unknowns with Weatherholt because he was expected to come into this season and play shortstop. He's really not been able to do that much. Last year, he played second base. He's played third base in the past. We've talked ad nauseum on this podcast about the lack of shortstops in this class. And if you can get a pure hitter like JJ Weatherholt to show you that he has a chance to play shortstop at even just a solid average level in pro ball, I think that really could be a separating factor with a lot of players in this class who are more limited at their defensive profiles and certainly don't have premium up the middle defensive value. Maybe with the exception of Travis Bezzana, these guys we're talking about at the very top. So I think that'll be fascinating. I'm really hoping that he's able to get back to 100% and put the glove on and get out in the field. And I'm curious, Peter, if you think he's back in the 1-1 conversation at this point, because really the only thing that's limited him is the injury. He entered the year 1-1. Yes, Charlie Condon and Travis Bezzana have been quite good, but do you think that Weatherholt, and I guess we can also slide Nick Kurtz into this conversation as well, since he started the year 2 on our board, do you think Weatherholt and or Nick Kurtz are solidly back in that mix, or would you have them just a little bit behind Condon, Bezzana, whoever else you want to include there?
That's a great question. I'm happy you brought up the point about the defense, because that's what thrust him into that initial number one ranking, was the positive reports out of Morgantown this fall, how he was handling himself at shortstop, how he was set to take over as the everyday shortstop. I'm really curious to see what they do with him defensively and how he looks at shortstop going forward. I think that's going to be really important. And then as far as the hamstring goes, I think it's certainly a little bit of a ding in the negative category for him. But I think, you know, if he's able to come back and you know, show that it's healed and show that he's healthy, he'd be able to reassure a lot of teams. But if he's like exclusively a DH or he's DHing one or two times a weekend, I don't think that would really, like for me at least, that wouldn't really do a lot in the reassurance department. But when it comes to the 1-1 discussion, I think him and Kurtz, and this is not necessarily a knock on them as much as it is an endorsement of how everyone else has been playing, I don't think they'd be in the 1-1 convo for me right now. For me, that's Travis Bezzana, Charlie Condon, and Braden Montgomery. Those are the three guys for me that if I were with the Guardians, those would be my three guys at the top. But it'll be interesting to follow how Kurtz and Weatherholt do the rest of the way, especially Kurtz now that he's on this tear. I know we'll get into it a little bit more, but they could certainly play their way back into that discussion. But for me, it's those three guys and then everyone else right now.
Yeah, I think I'd maybe be a little more bullish where I would have them. I might throw them straight into this conversation. I really think there is a group of like, honestly, 8 players. I think I would include Caglione, Chase Burns, and Hagen Smith. Like, I think you could make compelling cases for all these guys at the very top. I mean, for me and you personally, I think we're probably a little lighter on Caglione, but I understand if you're really big on just shooting for the upside and the outlier profile, where that would make sense. I personally wouldn't do it at 1, but I think having him in the conversation makes plenty of sense. We have him at 3 on our board right now. I'm with you. Like, I like Braden Montgomery quite a bit, and I think if I was deciding between a guy like Jack or Braden Montgomery, I would take him. But I also just have a lot of conviction in Nick Kurtz's hitting ability. The fact that he's starting to hit for power is encouraging. Same deal with JJ Weatherholt. And then at the same time, Chase Burns and Hagen Smith, maybe it would be weird to take a pitcher with all these other bats that have impact and power, and the pitchers are certainly inherently more risky. But you also look at the market for pitching in Major League Baseball right now. It's hard to find impact starters. It's harder to pay them and keep them for a long time. Maybe it's impossible to keep them healthy, which would add to just the risk factor of taking them 1-1, but they are pretty exceptional arm talents. So I think they have to be in the mix too. I think right now it's a pretty wide field of players up top, and I'm really curious to see who keeps performing down the stretch. Fingers crossed everyone stays healthy or keeps getting to their 100% health level. But yeah, let's talk a little bit more about Nick Kurtz, because he has just had an exceptional run lately. He's on a 6-game homer streak. He's homered 10 times in the last 6 games, including 3 multi-homer games. headlined by a 3-homer game against Virginia Tech in the series finale this past weekend. He has raised his overall line on the season up to 318, 512, 807, 13 home runs. He's still walking nearly at a 30% rate with about half a 15% rate in strikeouts. So he has woken up. Peter, what have you thought of this run? It's been kind of crazy to see just how frequently he stepped into his power.
Yeah, I don't want to give ourselves too much credit here, but I feel like when he was kind of going through that rough stretch and slow start, I feel like at least on one occasion, we had said it kind of felt like a breakout stretch was inevitable. You know, he's just too good of a player to not have. Yeah.
No, please pat us on the back as much as you can right now, Peter. Let's get
if we did say that, I'll have to go back and try and find it. If we did say that, it's a very cold take. He's an exceptional player. But even I didn't foresee something like this coming. I mean, it's like he's playing MLB The Show on beginner mode. It literally looks that easy for him right now. Mm-hmm. I can only imagine how he's feeling in the box. And I know he feels really good and he's feeling himself right now, and rightfully so. I think after the second home run on Tuesday against Coastal, when he was 2-for-2 with two bombs, he was 12 for his last 21 with 10 home runs, which is just
insane.
It's unbelievable. And he's now got 13 on the year. He's got 31 RBIs. He's hitting just a shade under 320. And he's really the same player as I thought he was coming into the year. He certainly returned to form. Like, it's easy plus power. It's probably a plus hit. He's a plus defender at first. It's still a really appealing profile. And as someone who's 6'5", like, this is a point that's been brought up a lot with Charlie Condon. And, like, typically with guys of that size and when you get the longer levers, it's easier for the swing to get a little bit out of sync and just to get elongated. But he has a pretty unique compactness and explosiveness, I think, to his operation. Like,
yeah.
The barrel flies through the zone. He doesn't sell out at all to get to his power. He gets the ball up in the air with authority on a very regular basis. And then you also talk about the advanced pitch recognition skills. Like, he seldom chases. He's consistently on the barrel. And I give him a lot of credit. Like, it would have been very easy for a lot of guys during that slow stretch to press and sell out a little bit and, you know, try and get to your power, but he was up there still taking his walks. Like, he was drawing, I think he has 3 games this year where he's drawn 4 walks.
Yeah.
Like, he's running a walk to strikeout ratio of 35-19. So it's like,
he still is number 2 in the country with his 28% walk rate. So
yeah, like, the approach is professional, and, you know, you're talking about at least 60s with his glove. And then the hit and the power combination. The glove is the most underrated aspect of his game, I think, because normally, you know, when you start talking about a first baseman, it's not the sexiest of profiles, but, you know, you've got a 6'5 kid over there who's light on his feet. He moves well. He's a pretty decent athlete. And he can really, really pick it. Like, he's an impact defender over there at first base. So, a very intriguing profile for sure. Like, I mean, if he keeps going like this, who's to tell, you know, where he starts getting talked about in the draft? And circling back to the point you made, I think it is, like, if you want to clump, like, guys into one tier, I think it's probably the 8 that you mentioned. And then when it comes to 1-1, like, he's still a little bit on the outside looking in. But, I mean, if he keeps tearing it up as ACC play goes on and, you know, we get into the tournament and he performs well, if Wake goes on a huge run here, you know, who's to say where he'll be discussed?
Yeah, I think if you were to say right now that he's your 1-1, you basically would have to have a lot of confidence that either the hit or the power, or just the combination of those two, were a tier ahead of a guy like Travis Bazzana or Charlie Condon, because both Condon and Bazzana offer more in terms of where they can play for you at more premium defensive positions. And Connie could still be a corner guy, and I think is most likely a corner guy, but the fact that he can play both outfield positions and the fact that you might have a chance for him to play third base, I think is maybe a differentiator there. And Condon has certainly shown that he is among the best pure hitters with maybe more raw power than Nick Kurtz has. I think I would maybe give Condon the edge with power and maybe Kurtz the edge with like pure hitting ability. But how you sum those two tools and put them together for an overall offensive grade, if they're still pretty close, I think it makes a lot of sense just to take the guy who you think has a chance to play a non-bottom of the defensive spectrum position. So I think that first base aspect with Kurtz will be the biggest limiter for him. Even if he's a plus defender, if he's a plus defender at first base and you don't think he can play any position but that, it still puts such a high bar that you need to clear offensively. And you look up at his total college resume, and it's pretty impressive. I mean, he's gotten on base over 50% of the time in his three-year career. He's at 52 home runs with Wake now. He's hitting the ball in the air this season at a much higher frequency than he has in the past, which is a great combination when you play at Wake Forest Park and you have the sort of power that he does. I'll be really curious to see where his home run total at the end of the day finishes at, because I mean, you can't expect him to continue this run going forward. And he did start off a little bit slower in the power department. It was two home runs in his first like 10, 13 games or so. So yeah, it'll be fascinating to continue watching him and seeing what he's doing. And he's already, after like a quote unquote slow start, he's still 15th in OPS right now among Division I hitters. And I think that obviously when you hit this many home runs in a short period of time, that helps. But he also really didn't have to improve much, because I think just the walk rate allowed him to stay at such a solid level. Like even without the hits falling, the fact that he is one of the best, I don't know how you describe it, one of the best walkers in baseball, the fact that he is so disciplined and knows what pitches to swing at and what not to, and you made a great point, the fact that he wasn't pressing and trying to get more hits to fall for him and forcing the issue with pitches that he knows he doesn't need to be swinging at, has allowed him to kind of, when you look up at the totality of his season, if you didn't know he started slowly, you probably wouldn't think anything of it. He looks like he's looked every year, and it's been fun to see.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to keep in mind, like, he's just not getting pitched to. Like, he is more recently, but, like, last year he saw strikes at, I think, oh, gosh, it was a 55% overall clip. It's down to 50% overall this year. And then when you're looking at just fastballs alone, last year he saw 59% fastballs for strikes. This year it's down to 52%. So it's like, when you get to pro ball, like, no one is really, you know, for the most part, like, everyone is going at opposing hitters. Like, you're not, like, the vast majority of the time, like, you're not pitching around guys in, like, low A, high A, like, as you work through professional baseball. So guys are going to be going at him.
Yeah, maybe college pitchers should stop going at him, because it feels safer to just let him go stand on first base. He's going to hurt you a lot less there than he will in the batter's box at this stage.
Yeah, well, selfishly, I like watching the kid swing the bat, because
100%.
It's a really impressive operate. Like he moves well in the box. Like you see it in the field. What you see it in the field too. But you know, I think he rotates super well, and again, there is like a little bit of an explosiveness to the operation that's really appealing. So very fun player.
Well, let's get into another player who is quite a bit of fun, a lot different in terms of profile, tool set, approach. But a player who I was asked about in a draft chat I had this week at baseballamerica.com. That was a lot of fun to do. So thank you guys for taking part in the draft chat and asking questions. But one player who I thought was fascinating, and a guy who we haven't really, I don't think we touched on too much on this podcast, is Mississippi State outfielder Dakota Jordan. He's been on a bit of a rampage the entire year. He's hitting 372, 506, 793 with 14 home runs. He's walking at a higher clip than he did a year ago. It's 19.9% compared to a 13.6% walk rate in his 2023 season. The strikeouts are still high, but the question was basically, what's preventing Dakota Jordan from being a top 20 player in this class at this point? He's a guy who we currently have in pretty safely in day one range, but I imagine will be a guy who continues to move up and certainly is a guy who has already gotten first round chatter despite some of the miss questions kind of inherent in his offensive profile. But what are your thoughts on what we've seen out of Dakota Jordan this spring, Peter? And I mean, I guess a secondary question would be, Have you seen a player who has as electric hand speed as Dakota does? Because I think he is solidly in my top tier of players, and I think he might even be the most explosive and quick hands I can remember seeing. That would include guys like the three I always think of are Austin Beck, Austin Hendrick, and Termar Johnson, I believe, are the three I typically use. But I think Dakota Jordan's might be just some of the quickest I've ever seen.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HOURENERGY.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HOURENERGY.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Well, I was going to say, for starters, like, he has top of the scale bat speed. Like, it is as thunderous as it gets. And for me, like, I think I described him at one point, he's one of, and I mean this in a positive way, kind of the one of the freakiest players in this year's draft. He had a really good freshman year. You mentioned that, like, he's a physical specimen at 6 foot, 220 pounds. The bat speed is, you know, for lack of better phrasing, it's downright electric. And last year, I don't have the data yet for this year, but his max EV of 118.6 was the fourth highest at the D1 level. And then his 90th percentile exit velocity of 112.6 was also the fourth highest mark.
Yeah. If you look at the, we did a story earlier before the season started plotting power, contact, and chase rates for hitters. And the only player, this was basically isolating top hitting prospects, so it wasn't just every player in the country, but it was basically at the very top in a tier of their own. Jack Caglione with 113.3 90th percentile EV from a year ago, and Dakota Jordan at 112.6. And then everyone else was like significantly lower than that. So there are these two dots that are just jumping out at the very top of this EV chart.
Yeah, and he's a really good athlete as well. He was a great football player in high school. And then this is where I'm going to kind of ding him a little bit, unfortunately. I kind of wonder about the long-term positional future with him. I think it might be like left field long-term, even for as good of an athlete as he is. He's got an average arm. I just kind of think that might be where he profiles best professionally. And then I also, you know, for as well as he's done this year, and, you know, he's got comfortably 60 grade raw power and this explosive operation in the box with top of the scale bat speed. And that's all good and well, but I just still have my concerns about the hit tool, and I really worry about what the strikeouts are going to look like professionally, kind of what the miss and chase is going to look like professionally, because there's still a fair bit of swing and miss to his game, and a little bit of pitch recognition issues, especially when it comes to spin.
Yep.
And, you know, the quality of pitching he's seeing in the SEC it's really good, but, you know, it's nothing compared to what you're going to see on a day-to-day basis in pro ball. So, like, I think he's a really good player. Would I take him in the first round if I was picking in the first round? No, probably not. Like, would I take him? I would start to think about him in like the middle-ish part of the second, like the middle of the second round is probably where I'd start thinking about him. And I know I might be a little bit low on him, and my hit tool concerns could be a little bit over exaggerated. That's just like the one thing that's holding me back right now.
No, I think those seem like justifiable concerns. I mean, that's the real big wart in the profile. You look at the bat speed, you look at the power, you look at the physicality, and there is a lot to dream on, but he has always been a fairly aggressive hitter with his swing decisions. It is nice to see him walking a little bit more often this spring, but I think the miss concerns are still there. It's a 34% miss rate overall. That miss rate is a lot higher against really all secondary pitch types. But then even if you isolate like 92 plus mile per hour fastballs, his fastball miss rate goes from like a 29% overall miss rate to 36% if you're just looking at 92 plus, which is maybe a little surprising for a guy with that sort of bat speed. I wonder if it's a case of him being a former two-sport guy where he just needs as many reps as possible to get used to that velocity. He is in a conference where he's seeing it consistently, so maybe we'll see some improvements with that throughout the rest of the conference slate. But I imagine he will be one of these players who has a fairly wide range of opinions. The people who are most optimistic on the hit tool evaluation or the development of his hitting ability and his approach at the plate, if you're on the highest range of outcomes for that tool, it's really easy to like the entirety of the profile. And if you're just more skeptical of him making those adjustments as he faces better pitching in pro ball, well, then the tools maybe aren't quite as exciting because you're not going to be able to tap into them as consistently as possible. So I don't imagine that he'll ever be a player that there's a really narrow window of consensus on where he goes, but he certainly has been a lot of fun to see. And I think he has made some improvements just in terms of outcomes and walk rate specifically. I mean, he's already matched his season high in homers from a year ago, which maybe is surprising considering how maybe just that, like the fact that he is accessing the power a little bit more frequently is a sign of some improvement there, but certainly a fun player to cover and watch.
Yeah, big time. I think he surpassed the home run and RBI total from last year with, you know, a handful of games left to go. And I'm with you. If you're confident in the hit tool being able to develop and you're confident in your org's ability to develop the hit tool to where it's, you know, solidly average, I think then yeah, that's someone you're going to probably think about in the first round. I don't know how high in the first round, but like, you know, if you're picking in the back half of it in that 25 to 30 or so range and, you know, you're bullish on the hit tool, like, you know, that's probably where you're going to pop him. And I'm with you that he's a little bit of a, probably a polarizing profile at this point. And I again, I might be on the lower side on him, but again, I just, the hit tool concerns are, mm-hmm. I can't get him out of my head. So he's more of a second round type for me, but
yeah,
you know, you
well, could... I think this combo and your concerns that you're bringing up, I think do kind of address the point that the question initially was, it was like, what's preventing him from being this high. And I think if you're all in on Dakota Jordan and you were kind of looking for a reason, I really think that is probably the biggest one, the most obvious question mark that he has that teams are going to wonder about moving forward. So I think the way you've gone about like highlighting it is maybe instructive.
Yeah, no, he'll be an interesting one to follow for sure.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to another hitter who is draft eligible sophomore. Dakota is a draft eligible sophomore, right?
Yes, he is.
Yeah. Let's get into another one. I've talked a lot about how there are not a ton of shortstops in this class. That's one of the areas of weakness I think about for the 24 draft class specifically. But we do have a shortstop in Jalen Flores, who going back to his high school time, he was a top 100 prospect in the 2022 class. Scouts really loved the actions at shortstop, his raw power potential with a really tall, lean, projectable frame, big arm strength. And then in his first year at Texas, it was really a bit of a struggle. He was not the team's full-time shortstop. He got some time at designated hitter. And as a DH, in total over 44 games, he hit 175, 293, 311. So really lost a lot of the kind of prospect hype that he entered college with. This year, he has been significantly better as a hitter. Through 34 games so far, he's hitting 365, 434, 752. After hitting just four homers a year ago, he's up to 13. This year, he has cut his strikeout rate nearly in half from 30% to 16.4%. The walk rate has also gotten chopped down. It was 12.2% a year ago, 6.9% now. So the numbers look fantastic. He's also playing shortstop every day. He's a guy who was an up arrow prospect on our last update. I'm still trying to figure out exactly where he slots in, but given his background, his performances here, his physical tools, his defensive work at shortstop, I mean, is Jalen Flores a guy we should be talking more about, Peter?
That's a great question. Like, I think so. And I think he's kind of flown under the radar due in large part to just, you know, how much he struggled as a freshman last year. But like you said, he's enjoying a big time career year right now at Texas. He's sitting over 360, tapped into some of that impact. And like, he's always been a defense first kind of guy. Like, I really like the actions and I really like the arm at shortstop. He's got a great body at 6'2", 210. I have no concerns about him sticking there professionally. He already plays a professional shortstop, at least in my mind. And then like the bat was the only question mark. And this year, you know, he's made some setup adjustments, which I think have really paid off. Like last year, he was more like wiggling the bat slash resting the bat over his back shoulder. There'd be a pretty exaggerated barrel tip.
Yep.
The swing path and hand path was a little long. And he kind of just tightened everything up this year. He took the bat off his shoulder. Mm-hmm. It's a medium high handset. There's still a little bit of a barrel tip. It's way less exaggerated. The hands are way more direct to contact. There's a little bit of hand and bat speed there. Like you see the adjustability that he's demonstrated and the dividends it's paid. And like, there's still a little bit for me, some hit tool concerns, especially like on the pitch recognition side. He's making contact at a little bit of a better clip. But he still has the tendency to expand the zone. But when you're talking about a class that, you know, it lacks true shortstops, especially at the college level, and like the potential for like impact bats up the middle, like I'm not all the way bought in on the bat, but like seeing the improvement year over year with Flores, it's been super, super encouraging. And if, you know, that's a guy that, you know, hopefully can continue to get better as he progresses.
Yeah.
And these adjustments have been super positive. Like for me, he's probably, assuming he keeps playing well as conference play rolls along, like, man, he's like a third to fifth round type, fourth to sixth round type for me right now. And trending in the right direction.
I think you broke that down excellently. I like the fact that you brought up the adjustments he's made to his just setup at the plate. One thing I noticed as well, it looks like he previously used a toe tap timing mechanism in the lower half. And this year it's been a little bit more of a leg lift and leg kick. So it feels like he's just been on time more consistently getting that foot down. The lower half and the upper half look more connected and just a little bit looser and more fluid this year than a year ago. He's also just letting it fly a lot more. He swung at a 42% rate last year. This year he's swinging at a 56% rate. That's a significant jump in just swings overall. So I wonder if the mentality was like, hey, I was too passive a year ago, maybe getting myself into bad counts. I'm just going to swing a lot more often now. That certainly reflects the strikeout and the walk rate, both those numbers being down. But when I did see just the raw numbers overall and looked under the hood to some of the swing decisions and contact numbers, I was a little surprised how frequently he was chasing, just because I expected with the strikeout rate to go down so much that maybe the chase rate would go down. But that feels more like just a how often are you actually swinging the bat decision. The chase rate is actually up from a year ago. He chased at a 30% rate in 2023. That chase rate is up to 38% of the time. So it really does feel like it's not so much an adjustment in like, oh, he's now seeing the ball better out of the hand. He's just like, I'm going to swing more often. And in terms of production, that has paid off and worked well for him. But I would echo some of the same concerns that you have about what is the hit tool ultimately at the next level. I know in the past there are some questions about him being a little bit too pull happy in general. I'm not sure if those are still significant questions. I do know most of his power in game has come to the pull side. I think he's got a chance to maybe get to some opposite field power with just how big he is. But even if you're not the best pure hitter in the world, if you can stick at shortstop and you have the tools to play there, it's a lot easier of a load to manage offensively. And I do agree with you. I think he looks the part of a shortstop at the position. I like the way he moves. I like how fluid his actions are. The arm, I think, gives him a chance to make really impact plays in the hole. So he's a fun player, if still a player with some warts and maybe some more pure hitting questions than you would expect given the line that he's managed, but certainly a strong improvement year over year for him and a guy that I'll be curious to see where Texas scouts are really putting on their draft boards.
Yeah, and being a guy that, you know, you can be really confident in sticking at shortstop plays in your favor in every draft, but even more so this year, that's only going to help his stock, I think. And there are a lot of positives, even with the hit tool concerns. Like you mentioned something that I was going to say, and that I think that there's even a little bit more impact to get to. And it's clear like the overall confidence is up in the box. Like it just almost looks like a weight has been taken off his shoulders and he can like finally just fly around and play and flash his tool set. So again, with how the hit tool is like the hit tool progression is my biggest question and concern. But I think that, you know, the year over year improvement and then also the current tool set that he's flashing, it makes for a really appealing profile. So like third to fifth may have been a little rich when I initially talked about it, but
I don't think so.
Yeah. Three to six would be where I'd have him right now. Like probably, closer to sixth than the third, but trending up.
I think too, for teams that just put a lot of emphasis on just college production and performance overall, you think of a shortstop in a power conference with tools and production. It checks a lot of boxes. I mean, I was going to mention this when we were talking about the hit tool questions, but really, if you don't have hit tool questions, you're probably going to be pretty high up on the draft board. And in a 20 round draft, there are going to be a lot of players you take where there are significant hit tool questions. Hitting is the trickiest thing to do and the hardest thing to do on a baseball field and to project in a prospect moving forward. So there are going to be a lot of players taken who have those questions. But if you have a lot of secondary tools and you profile nicely and you do have performance, there's still a lot to like about you. When we're talking about fourth, fifth, sixth round picks, we're not talking about a lot of plus or above average hitters in that range. So I think that makes some sense. But any other thoughts on Jalen before we move on?
No, I think we hit on him well, but when I thought you brought up a great point as well. When you're talking about like warts and wartless guys, like there are really only two players I can think of that are quote unquote wartless. And like even those two guys, like they have their things that they need to work on. So it's like everyone that we discuss more or less is going to have their kind of red flags, so to speak, to the profile.
Absolutely. All right. Well, we talked a lot of hitters today. I think every prospect we've gotten into actually has been a hitter. Let's talk about a pitcher. This was brought up on a podcast Ben and I did recently, Peter. And I think Ben maybe was just trying to pat himself on the back because he took this pitcher in our staff draft. But I thought he brought up an interesting conversation. And that pitcher is Treya Savage at East Carolina, right-handed pitcher who has really done an excellent job this year. He's got a 1.86 ERA over eight starts, 48.1 innings. He's striking out a lot of batters, nearly a 40% strikeout rate, while still walking 7.4%, which is the same walk rate he managed a year ago. He right now, I believe, is fifth overall among D1 pitchers with total strikeouts. And he's just consistently posted this year. And Ben was basically asking, like, after Hagen Smith and Chase Burns, is Treya Savage the SP3 on draft boards at this point? And I thought he made a pretty compelling case. And I think that if you look around, there are some players that you can maybe talk about as being in this range. But I think if you wanted to make the case for Treya Savage as SP3 and pushing towards kind of that like top 10 range, I don't really have a real answer for why that's not the case. What do you think?
I think it's certainly an interesting point, and it's certainly not an outlandish take, because you know you've got Burns and Smith jockeying for that SP1 position right now. I think it's pretty clearly those two guys, and then afterwards, in terms of college arms, I think you've got a next tier of Brody Brecht, Jonathan Santucci, and probably Treya Savage would be like my next three. And like, I could certainly see an argument in a world where like you're taking a Savage over Santucci and Brecht. Personally, I'd lean a little bit towards the other two guys, maybe not both of them, but like Brett, like your Savage for me is certainly in that SP3 to SP5 range. It's a legit four pitch mix. It's a workhorse, durable starter frame. Like, track record of health, knock on wood, has been excellent. And again, when you talk about a draft, like similar to the lack of shortstops, there's a little bit of a lack of depth when you can kind of point to a guy and say, okay, I have no concerns that he's going to start long term and not need to move to the bullpen. Like, your Savage is one of very few arms that fit that. And it's a really, like, it's a very, I enjoy the profile a lot too, because he's not just like this durable innings eater guy where the stuff lacks. Like, it's, for me, it's third starter upside. It's a four pitch mix, fastball up to 98 with a ton of life and carry through the zone. you can make the argument that it's a plus pitch. He also has mixes in and has pretty good feel for two distinct breaking balls. And then the pitch that I've become a particular fan of this year, like I always was impressed with his ability to spin it. But this year I've become a big fan of his split change that he started to deploy more. It gets really good separation off his fastball. He'll throw it to both right and left-handed hitters. It has ultra late tumbling life. It just kind of falls off a table 1 to 2 feet in front of the plate, and he kills spin really well, throws it with conviction. Like, it's flash plus, and you can make the argument that you're looking at a guy with at least 3+ pitches, who's a slam dunk starter, really good body, advanced strike thrower. Like, there are so many positive traits when you're looking at him. And I think I may have talked myself like a little bit higher into a Savage than where I am right now. Like, I'd feel certainly... like
that's kind of the experience that I had too, because the separator, I feel like, with your Savage and some of these other pitchers who I think still have a case for SP3 is there's really no clear, obvious area of weakness for him. He might not have the most like explosive, wow, pure stuff, but I think you mentioned it, like he's got a pretty well-developed, well-rounded arsenal. I think you could easily argue that he's got 3 above average pitches. The fact that he has shown usability of the fastball and multiple secondaries, the fact that he can land, he can establish the fastball in the zone, the fact that he can throw the changeup and the slider in the zone. I don't think the curveball is like some like devastating pitch, but he can throw it in there and flip it in there as a change of pace offering. He just does a lot of things really well. And that pitchability element really could be a separator for him when you're looking at guys like a Brody Brecht, who has consistently struggled with strike throwing and always is going to have that really huge reliever risk. And a guy like Jonathan Santucci, who throughout conference play has really struggled to throw the fastball for strikes, and that has hurt him. I think in my mind, Treya Savage is kind of on an up arrow tendency. And for as much as I like Jonathan Santucci and think he can be a really good pitcher, I feel like he's been trending down because he just hasn't been posting in conference play. He's walked a lot of batters. Treya Savage, on the other hand, has posted every single week. He hasn't walked more than 2 batters in an outing. He has 3 11 strikeout games, including a week 2 matchup against North Carolina. That's going to look good. I mean, he's been one of the more consistent starting pitchers in college baseball. And I feel like on draft day, if you're looking around, there's a lot of hitters at the top. GMs and owners really love being able to just take a college starter they feel confident in. And if you look around with a guy who has the combination of stuff, performance, and strikes, like, Savage checks a lot of those boxes. Maybe you can maybe make the case that like you're giving up a little bit of upside potential, but what you're giving up there, I think you might be making back in safety a few times over.
Yeah, no doubt. And the 3.6s I gave him might be a little bit bullish, but it's for sure at least 3.55s in the arsenal. And when you compare him to Brecht and Santucci, I think it becomes a really fascinating and tough argument to sort out, like in the top 20 or so picks, because with Brecht, obviously, you've got an elite level athlete. You've got this low mileage arm with some of the highest end stuff, perhaps the highest end stuff in this year's draft, strike throwing issues, but like the track record of development with those types of guys has actually been kind of decent in recent memory. And if you get him in the right org, like you're looking at, you know,
it almost feels like depending on which guy you like might just depend on the confidence you have in your pitching development group or what you think your development group does well. Like if you're a group that thinks you can add stuff, but struggles maybe with getting pitchers to throw more strikes, maybe Savage is just the guy. And if you feel confident about ironing out mechanics and getting guys more direct to the plate and just putting the ball over the plate more, and you feel like you've got a decent track record of doing that, then maybe you would prefer to take an upside shot on a guy like Brecht. So it's an interesting conversation to have, but man, Savage has just been so consistent this year.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then you throw Santucci into the mix. You've got an athletic left-hander with, again, you know, potentially 3 above average offerings, the potential for 2+ offerings with the likelihood that he's going to start. That's an appealing profile as well. I'm with you that I think Santucci is kind of creeping in the wrong direction, whereas Savage is going in the right direction. And I think at this point, like Brody Brecht, like he just is who he is. Like it, you know, it's elite stuff. The strike throwing is really an issue, but you know, you've got a 6'4" former football player, an elite mover, electric arm speed with you know, even more electric stuff, but the strike throwing has clearly not ironed itself out. So it's going to be really fascinating once we get, you know, outside of the top 10, I think, where this draft ends up going, especially in terms of how these arms work themselves out. Because I know for sure right now, like, I'm taking Trey Savage and not really thinking twice about it. I'm taking him over Josh Hartle, Drew Beam, Ben Hess, Luke Holman. Like, I no doubt about it.
Yep. It's crazy, too. Thinking of Jonathan Santucci and the strike throwing struggles he's had, he actually has a higher walk rate right now at 15.8% than Brody Breck does at 15.5%.
That's a great nugget.
So Jonathan Santucci, I mean, he's always been 10+%, but it was 11% in 2022 when he threw 41 innings split as a starter and reliever. It was 12.5% in 2023 when he started the first seven games of the season, then dealt with injury. And then this year it's been 15.8%. And really, I think a lot of it is just the fastball command. I mean, he's throwing the slider and fastball roughly equal at this point, but whereas Trey Savage is throwing the fastball for strikes at a 68% rate, I believe Santucci's is like 56 or something like that. It's a sub 60% number, which is not what you want. And then Brody Brecht, while he still has significant strike throwing concerns, it's kind of over his career, it's trended in the right direction. It's 21.2%, which is just insane. 18.4%, and then this year through eight starts, it's 15.5%. So I didn't actually think coming into this podcast that was the case, but just pulling up their numbers and looking at them, I think maybe highlights just how much we need Santucci to just put the ball over the plate moving forward.
Oh, absolutely. And it's literally since, like, we talked him up huge, like, before leading into that Wake series in early March, it's been all downhill. Like, he's really struggled at times, but no, it'll be fun to see how it all shakes out.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Pierre, that's all I had for today. Anything you want to mention, plug, talk about before we get out of here?
Just my usual stuff. My top 50 2026 college guys dropped last week. Go check it out. It's got some in-depth scouting reports on all 50 guys, and it's a good initial look, I think, at a pretty intriguing class, at least on the college side. And then on a weekly basis, I'll collaborate with Teddy on the top 25 rankings. We'll do the 25 capsules each Tuesday. Carlos and I drop the hot sheet, which is a ton of fun both to put together and also write up, especially when you like, for me, it's always, there are always headliners on the prospect side, which is a lot of fun, but when you get to these smaller school mid-major guys who show out, it's fun to look at how they did over the weekend, and then also if you can kind of dive under the hood a little bit and see if you know, found a potential guy. So that's always a lot of fun to do. And then every Thursday I've got my What to Watch For piece. It's out if you're listening to this right now. And also every Thursday College Podcast with Teddy, and every Friday the Draft Podcast. So no shortage of content, and it'll only keep on rolling as we get, you know, further into the college season and as the draft cycle progresses.
Absolutely. Yeah. I had a draft chat this week that's on the site now. If you just want more draft talk, some good questions from readers there. I also dug Morrison, Nick Kurtz, and JJ Weatherholt and kind of their status in the class right now. If you really haven't seen much of Weatherholt, it's kind of an at bat by at bat breakdown of his first series back. So that was kind of fun to do, maybe a little bit different style of piece. But I was very much looking forward to seeing all those ABs. So it was fun to do, but yeah. Thank you, Peter, for hanging out and talking draft. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you to all the BA subscribers for supporting the show and supporting the website and letting us do this, because we could not do it without you guys. So thank you so much for the support. For Peter, I'm Carlos. We will see you guys next time.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.